Hi, this is Paul. Welcome to the Things I Didn't Learn in School podcast. For those of you that are newer to these conversations, the podcasts are one of three things that Still Press puts out. There's also a weekly essay that comes out on Substack. You can sign up for either the free or the paid versions on my website, paulpodolsky.com. And there's also a book, Raising a Thief, and another one that's going to join it soon, Master Minion. And if you enjoy these conversations, I think that you will enjoy the books and the essays as well. And so with that, thanks for listening, and let's get into our conversation. My guest today is David McCloskey, who is a spy, a writer, father, husband. So welcome to Things I Didn't Learn in School.
Thanks for having me, Paul. Great to be here.
We just spent a bunch of time talking about your book and what else you got in the pipeline. But for those people who don't know you, why don't you just give a little bit of an introduction and go back a little bit, if you will. Like, where'd you grow up? Who were mom and dad? Just give a sense of your background.
I grew up mostly in Florida and in the Midwest. My dad's a university professor. My mom had the unfortunate job of raising two children, me and my sister. I went to school outside of Chicago, ended up through connections at school, ended up at the CIA, but grew up mostly in Minnesota.
The CIA recruited you when you were whatever the recruiting. Yeah, it's not uncommon.
Yeah, not uncommon. It's less common now, but at the time there was a pretty big kind of undergraduate internship program that they had, and it meant that they took, you know, kids, I mean, literally kids, like I was 19 when they came on campus to join the agency and kind of go through the full process of the poly and the medical, the psych and all that to get in and get your clearance. And then they literally, it's just kind of crazy. You know, you're 19 and you're like, okay, I'm actually sitting at Langley doing the work. But it was a very, very cool program. So I got plugged into that because an alum who was running the sort of Middle East analytics shop at the CIA came through Chicago and swung by my pretty small liberal arts school. They don't recruit there normally, but he came. And, you know, as a 19-year-old, I think, you know, most of my experience working up to that point had been as a cashier at Wendy's. And so it was like, okay, the CIA is here. That seems like a pretty big step up. I'll see what they have to say, which is how I ended up, you know, I was fortunate enough to get in. But pretty normal, I mean, normal childhood, normal growing up, you know.
What did your dad teach? What was his specialty?
He actually teaches at a seminary, teaches leadership courses for people who become pastors and work in churches and all that. You know, he's written books himself and big reader and writer. And I think some of that rubbed off on me, although in a very, very different way, I guess.
Was it a very observant upbringing in terms of like the family dynamic?
Yeah, mm-hmm. I would say so. I think that's a good way to put it. And a very happy childhood, right? I look back on it very fondly.
What about the interest in espionage? Was that something that was early on in you? Or was there a history of government service? Or was there something, or were you really, you know, did you see like, read a book? Or like, where did that come from? Or is it just sort of like you were 19 compared to Wendy's, it was a no-brainer?
I mean, you know, I sort of joke about that, but I think there's a lot of truth to it. I'm a 19-year-old. I'm not coming out of a family environment where there is a sense that, like, you're going to go do this thing. Mm-hmm. And I'm not in a milieu where it's like, you know, there's a lot of family pressure or a lot of families around us that are sort of driving children to one or more, you know, jobs or whatever. So it felt very kind of blank slate to me, which, you know, at the time was confusing because there's so many different choices, but
right, you just figure it out.
Right, looking back on it, you know, it's a huge blessing because I really could kind of do what I wanted, and I think at the time, you know, if I sort of put myself back in 18, 19-year-old David's shoes, I think a lot of it was driven by this desire to kind of understand. I like to learn a lot; it drives me in my writing. It drove me in the consulting work. It drove me at the CIA, and I think there was something about the CIA that made me think, I'll understand how things work if I work here.
Yeah, I totally get that.
You know, I can sort of get to the bottom of things and see the world and understand, like, how do governments work? I think any sort of big organization that was trying to solve or big problems or understand the world, if they had shown up at, you know, 19-year-old David's doorstep, I would have been really interested. And I think it was just sort of, a little bit happenstance that it was the Central Intelligence Agency.
Was there any notion of service when you were growing up and family, that sort of being like a value, like be of service and this is a way to be of service, or not so much?
I think there's a missional piece to this. My parents worked for a long time with missionary organization. You know, my dad's teaching at a seminary. Uh-huh. I think there's a sense of like connecting vocation to something bigger than you that has always been important in my family. And I think it felt satisfying at the CIA because, I mean, you know, we'll, I'm sure we'll get into this. You know, the day-to-day of the job sometimes is maddening. It's bureaucratic. It's all the things. It's all the things that happen if you're working in a big organization anywhere. But I do think that there's this kind of motivating thread that often connects what you're doing day-to-day with something that's much bigger than you, and I think really important. And so that's that's a really set and just kind of knowing that that's there, even on days where you don't sort of feel it in an emotive or kind of raw way, but knowing it's there matters a lot.
I guess you're allowed to tell mom and dad that you're working at the CIA.
Yeah.
So they're allowed.
They're allowed.
And then when they were they like, great? Or, you know, depending on, obviously, when you talk about observance, there's a huge span of different approaches. Some of them could be very enthusiastic, and some of them might say, listen, I have moral qualms about this for X, Y, or Z reasons. Right. Was there any of that discussion, or was it just sort of, this is fantastic?
No, it's mostly just pride. I think my dad was really excited about it and thought it was really cool. You know, it's sort of like this kind of gut level of you know, because it's secret, right? And so, even though I think everyone kind of understands that a lot of really normal stuff happens at CIA, because most people don't have access to it, you kind of approach it through the lens of Hollywood. And then, so that's the starting point, you know, is like, I'm doing something kind of close to this or associated with this. And that's really cool. And I think that's how he saw it.
And then your work in the Middle East, what was the function? Were you a case officer? Were you an analyst? Was it?
I was an analyst. And when I was writing the book, I quickly realized that, you know, even fictionalizing the day-to-day of my job would be too boring for a book. And so I went with the case officer as the protagonist and put the analyst in as a little, you know, a little side piece for a couple segments. But no, I was an analyst.
Which means you could work under your actual name, correct? In other words, when you met people, you were David. Yeah.
When I met people, I'm David. I'm overt, which means that like on my tax returns, I work at the Central Intelligence Agency. I don't have to, it's not wise to share that information super broadly for obvious reasons, but you don't have to hide it. So it made life and continues to make life a lot easier for me than folks who are undercover for 20, 30 years, you know.
And then were you mostly served geographically? What countries were you spending most of your time in?
I worked literally the whole time on Syria. And so I lived in Syria for a while. Almost all of my travel was sometimes to Europe, but almost always to the Middle East.
Got it.
So, you know, Jordan, Israel, Turkey, Saudi, the rest of the Gulf, all that.
One thing I've always wondered about with spies, I have some long-sitting friends who also went down that path, and they were the changing the identities. That was part of their, in other words, they lived under a fake name. And when they got on the plane and they got out of the United States, it's literally everything was different down to like the Blockbuster cards in their wallet type thing. Which I've always thought is there's this unbelievable paradox to me of the type of person who would be both attracted to the CIA and to whom the CIA would be attracted, and the ability to basically embrace so deeply that mental adjustment for lack of a more accurate word, basically lying day in, day out. Yes, you're doing it in the service type of thing, but oh my God, what an adjustment to make to be in. I had this acquaintance of mine who I worked in the financial world with when we had meetings with in certain cases before we got in. He would say, give me a moment to get in character. And I never understood what he meant. Like a lot of times salespeople are preparing for things and stuff like that. But I think what he meant was that was the training of that type of, and if you're, you know, you could just say shorthand is preparing for the meeting. So fair enough.
Right,
but this is a different type of preparation. In other words, if I say to David, like, you know, my actual name is, you know, Robert Strauss the whole time. And I'm telling you the whole time I'm Paul Podolsky and I have a website and everything like that. For me, the mental strain would be, I think it would be wow, but maybe I could just get used to it. I don't know. What do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, let me put it this way. I mean, I don't think when you're talking about case officers in particular, because I do think there's a lot of different jobs at the CIA and they all involve some level of comfort with the reality that most of the work that you're doing is secretive and that it has to stay that way. Right. And so there's a mental adjustment there because like most jobs aren't really like that to that degree.
Correct.
But when you're talking about case officers, I'm great friends with many of them, their contacts, their former colleagues, like it's fascinating. I think that world and the psychology of the job, you know, as you're hinting at, is this, it's, I don't think any of them would be offended by me saying this, but they're not normal people.
I don't think you can be, right?
I don't think you can be to do a lot of these jobs.
You've got to be like an expert compartmentalizer to a certain degree to be able to do that, I think. And I don't know what childhood preparation allows one to do that better or worse, or maybe it's just totally random, but it seems to me it's like a high degree. Compartmentalization is part of all of our lives, but in that life particular,
right,
and it's all over the world, there's different agencies that are trying to do the same to us. It really seems, I've just always wondered about that.
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Money is all around us, and we think about it more than almost every other aspect of our lives. But how can we make more of it, and what's our drive for building wealth beyond just the numbers in our bank account? Join us on the Make More podcast as our host Matt Heslin brings to you a dynamic lineup of experts in the world of investing, business, health, and beyond. Together, they unpack the secrets to not just surviving, but thriving in today's economy. It's about more than just wealth. It's about crafting life experiences, seizing opportunities, and building a legacy. Subscribe now to the Make More with Matt Heslin podcast and join us every week for new expert insights and inspiration.
There's a component of kind of adrenaline, not adrenaline junkie necessarily, but like I think a comfort in risk taking.
Interesting.
Most of them, not most of them, all of them are very smart. You have to have an incredible amount of mental horsepower to do the work and to keep things in your head organized and structured. And the way that they view the world around them is very different from the way we would view it, and it's happening in their head, you know.
Yes.
Like a lot of it they can't write down when it's happening, and so they have to be very energized, I think, by working in the shadows. And by that I mean there's an excitement that comes with you know, I'm the one who has the secret I'm winning because I'm in the shadows and you don't know where I am, particularly when we're talking about kind of street trade craft and things like that.
Yeah. It's a form of real power too, particularly if you have like the United States military behind you, like you then you quietly, and you're acting like somebody else. And I imagine you identify a target, walk back, and finally through every channel as it gets there, and the U.S. military comes sweeping in. The sense of power has to be enormous.
Well, I think there's that, but I'm speaking more about like the street trade craft of a lot of these guys who are working in environments that are hostile or at least not friendly, you know, are preparing extensively for months, weeks, for very short operational acts that are extremely high risk, a quick face-to-face meeting, moving car encounter, brush pass, servicing a dead drop, things like that. These are not long, right? But they're doing a tremendous amount of preparatory work, much of which is in their brain, to prepare for these things. And there has to be a level of excitement that comes with knowing that by doing that act, you're winning and someone else is losing. And there's I think some of them would describe it as almost like a godlike sensation of like knowing that they're beating the opposing service at this game.
Yeah.
And there has to be excitement that comes from that and not fear, because the good ones, at least I'm told, I don't have firsthand experience at this, right? Which is an important caveat, will say like, they're not thinking about when they're doing these things, they're not thinking about, oh man, I might screw this up. They're thinking about how exciting it's going to be when they win. And that's a very different mentality, I think a lot of analysts, the way our brains work is we're kind of thinking about like negative downside risk.
The case officers have to,
they're not just taking risks for the hell of it, but they have to be wired in such a way that they're not overcome by them to then go forward and do this pretty, pretty high risk work.
I think the wiring is, I was thinking about that just recently. You know, if you see that guy, I don't know if you saw the documentary Free Solo about the guy, Alex Honnold, who climbs El Capitan without.
Yes. Yes. That's awesome. Yeah.
They do a thing of his brain. There's like, oh, he's missing the fear component. And I'm like, got it. You know, I've been on top of Half Dome and looked down from the top. You know, you can climb up the side and look down.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And to not experience a sense of fear looking over something like that, you're wired differently.
Yeah.
Those people who haven't read Damascus Station, I read it and I really enjoyed it. And I'm not alone. If you look on Amazon, there's lots of people who do. And it has a whole mix of fascinating characters, really interesting point in time, and also elements of it are like classic, but for the modern world, we need these stories retold, spy, tradecraft type of stuff. It was a little bit like, you're cutting out all the boring parts of the CIA stuff and honing in on precisely the most intriguing things. And then you, of course, you make it exponential because you have the main character cross the line that no CIA person ever should, which is fall passionately in love with his target.
Right. That's right. No, leaving out the boring parts of the job, you're making me think of the Elmore Leonard, who wrote a bunch of very wonderful books. I think one of the most well-known is Get Shorty, which became a wonderful movie with Danny DeVito in it.
Oh, I haven't seen that. I got to put that in.
He has these like wonderful rules for writing. And one of them is leave out the parts that most people tend to skip.
Steve Martin. Do you hear of your Steve Martin reviews books?
No.
He goes, my criteria is the following. He goes, there's two types of books. There's books you can put down and books you can't put down. I like to read the books that you can't put down.
Yeah, it's basically that. So when I started writing this book, I left the CIA in 2014 for a whole host of reasons. I spent 3 months that summer just writing, and it was not structured. It was more, I think, kind of an emotional reaction to coming off working on Syria and the Civil War and having lived there, worked on it for what up to that point had been basically all of my adult professional life. And so I was just writing, and it was, you know, 100,000 words, so a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
But I put it aside. I came back to it 5 years later, and I was like, "This is really terrible." You know, I mean, there's no plot. There's it's not structured. But I knew I wanted to write a book that was about Syria and that dealt authentically with it. I knew I wanted to do a CIA book that also kind of got down to the core of the place. I mean, it got the tradecraft right, but even more important to me was like kind of trying to say something real about the culture of the place, the ethos of the place. Mm-hmm. And so those things were really important to me. Mm-hmm. But to your point, most of the work is not very exciting. And so I was sort of, I think, walking a fine line between doing something like a CIA procedural, you know, where you're showing the reality of, okay, there's bureaucracy. There's more than two people in the organization. I mean, most spy novels, you know, or thrillers, kind of any organization is essentially boiled down to like one or two people that are doing all the work in that book. And, you know, I have a little bit of that here because you just can't deal with all the complexity,
right?
You know, in a story that someone wouldn't want to put down. But I did want to hint at the policy, the procedure, the bureaucracy, but then also try to write a book that was propulsive and that drew people forward into the narrative, which ultimately is what you're trying to do when you're writing fiction.
My experience of writing is basically like, it doesn't surprise me whatsoever that your first draft was terrible. You know, the way I think about it is Tolstoy's a genius.
Yeah.
And he wrote War and Peace 7 times before he got it right. And that's for a genius. You may or not like War and Peace, but over time it sort of stood the test of time, which I think is the ultimate test for any piece of literature. So I'm like, you know, 6 drafts completely within the realm. How long did it take you to go through this thing, just writing and rewriting, or were you a faster writer?
I'm pretty fast, I think. I started from first sort of initial kind of thoughts or outlines or words in the second iteration of this whole thing to like draft ready to submit to editors, like where I thought it was 8 months.
Mm-hmm. That's fast.
With almost all the writing happening in six.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's pretty fast. But then there was another rewrite after that.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, the whole thing, my process has basically been, I try to get a certain number of words down every day.
How many?
Usually between 2,000 to 4,000.
Uh-huh. That's a lot.
And 2,000 is the absolute minimum. But mm-hmm. if it's below that, like something horrible has gone wrong. Mm-hmm. And there are days where I can do six mm-hmm. if things are really humming. But it's an input based. It's like, okay, there's a daily metric of word count. My books, Damascus Station and the one I have in edit now, are both around 120,000 words. I think in each of those, I ended up writing around 300 to 350,000
mm-hmm.
to dig the story out. And so I have not yet found a way to get to the best possible, tightest story without just writing and right. editing right. over and over again to throw stuff out, move things around. It's really a sloppy, messy process, but I don't know anything different.
And then there's this breed of writers, you know, the Michael Connellys, et cetera, that just churn out stuff that people can't put down like every 12 months. I mean, it's just like right. a conveyor belt. And I haven't read it all, but I've read a chunk of it's good stuff. It's pretty amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. I can start to wrap my head around that if you're dealing with the same characters over and over again, which uh-huh. most of these guys are.
Oh, that's interesting insight.
I think, you know, my second book, only one character carries over. So uh-huh. the whole cast is different. It's a totally new setting for me, which is Russia. I had to do a whole bunch of research to feel like
I
could build an authentic world. And it took a lot of time to do that. And mm-hmm. especially creating four or five kind of new main characters was really, you know, would one star out of five, like would not recommend in terms of doing that if you're trying to get stuff out quickly. But if I was dealing with the Damascus Station characters and sort of the same universe and setting, I could start to wrap my head around how these guys and gals can do that one, like every year.
Interesting.
Because for me right now, like the second book took me so long that it's not going to be out until next fall. So it's like an every other year schedule right now, which I'm hoping
that's pretty
to avoid going forward. But
you're trying to get into the every year schedule going
I'm trying
forward.
To get into the every year. Yeah.
Got it.
Yeah.
What was it like to go from, so you're an analyst, which is obviously very fact-based. You're at McKinsey for a number of years as a consultant. It's also very fact-based. And now you're making stuff up. Yes, it's based on stuff, but you're sitting there and you're making stuff up. What was that transition like to go for you?
That makes me think of a great quote from Larry McMurtry of Lonesome Dove fame. Someone asked him once why he liked writing books. And he said, I just really like to make things up. And there is something that's really fun about that. Uh-huh. Like to just create something, make something up, and to know that it has to behave according to rules, right? I'm not writing, even science fiction has to behave according to the rules of the universe that the author has created, but that you kind of get to set some of the rules and you get to make things up and you get to choose what you show and don't show and all that. That's really fun. And I got a lot of energy from switching the type of writing I was doing from pretty cold analytic stuff at both the CIA and McKinsey to something that was the opposite of that.
Yeah, emotion.
For me, it was a lot of fun. And it's taken some practice because I don't have any formal, writing training. I didn't study it in college really at all. But I've just found there's nothing more painful than sitting down with that blank page and trying to create something out of nothing. But then, you know, when you kind of look at a book when it's done or even a chapter when you're like, that's pretty good. And you look at that and you say, like, I have created this thing. That feeling that's why I keep doing it.
Oh, it's amazing. A former colleague of mine said, if you look at measures of the brain in terms of satisfaction, one of the absolute highest pleasure points you wouldn't think is when the light bulb goes off and you're like, wow, I didn't understand that before. That's a connection that I hadn't made. The sniper scene. There were a couple of the ones here where you go into meticulous stuff about bombs.
Yeah.
And then there's a really beautifully written, I was flipping through the pages here. I don't seem to see where I've marked it. Really, I mean, it's kind of a horrific thing to describe, somebody taking another's life, but it's described the sniper scene, to my mind, not being a sniper, but very intimately and fluidly. How did you pull that off?
Well, so this is in my approach with anything that any kind of technical topic or yep. a scene that lends itself toward that is I first write the scene essentially doing research on YouTube and the internet of just
Google's
just,
great.
Just basic stuff of like and I yeah. kind of I do that because I generally don't want the technical stuff. I want it to complement the scene's propulsion or some development around character and not clog it, ideally. And so yep. I'm generally not concerned the first time through about getting this stuff really right. But mm-hmm. what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to find the beat from a character or plot propulsion standpoint that's going to carry the story forward and keep people interested. And so the first time I'm writing, I'm trying to find that more than the technical stuff, but I find I have to do a little bit of the mm-hmm. technical research so that I don't feel like I'm totally making stuff up. And then I'll usually kind of hammer away at the character or the plot stuff a little bit first. And then once I realize that the scene is probably going to be in the book, because like I said, I end up throwing so much stuff away.
Yeah.
Once I realize it's going to be in the book, then I typically will try to find somebody that actually knows something about the topic.
I was like, somebody looked at this thing who was taking shots.
And then the answer was there were two snipers who read it and who I spoke to and who were like, okay, here's the kind of, they would use this, you know, they'd use this type of gun. Here's how they'd set it up. Here's how they'd be thinking about it. Here's how they'd build the blind. Like, then you sort of into that kind of detail. And I take a couple pages of notes and then I go in and then I'll edit it. And then I'll send it back to them and usually try to offer them whiskey or something to bribe them with. And then they'll read it again. They'll actually line edit it and then send it back to me. And that's what goes in the book.
That makes sense. Because I read that and I was like, you know, from everything that I've always been curious of that world, but everything I was like, this very much resonates. And I imagine with the bombs, it was the same type of thing.
Yeah. Although the cadavers were made up. I made those up. The guy who, the EOD tech who read it, was like, you know, this is crazy, right? Like, we would never do this. And he'd crossed the whole thing out. And that's why it's fiction. And I was like, you know what? I just had too much fun with this. I'm going to keep it. And I found a lot of the technical stuff. But like,
well, it's the author's privilege. You're allowed to say, and that's why it's fiction.
If you lay enough groundwork of authenticity and realism, there are points in a book where you can just get away with.
Yeah, once you got people lured in and they're like, oh, I know what that person's like, then you can pull more magic tricks out.
That's right.
In a draft of something I'm working on, I put in a scene that's literally magic. It's about somebody it's about somebody visiting Volshebnik, what they call like a wizard or sorcerer in Russia. And I gave my thing to beta readers too. And I thought that people would go crazy at that scene because it's a magic trick that's like a completely inconceivable magic trick. Not a single reader has said anything about that. They've said other stuff about, well, what about X, Y, Z? But this thing, they glide right over. And that for me is a real lesson. Your book is infused with heat. It's hot there. And there's a lot of, seriously, there's a lot of scenes there. Where did I have this one marked? 301. The morning was hot and humid. Even worse than the heat was being stuck in driving a Mitsubishi Pajero on a busted Saturday. And I just thought of like right there, I was like, I'm in a crappy car. It's hot as hell. And you know what, you're dreaming of like, I want to be underwater and there's no escape. Do you think that climate change, everything is making this whole region even more unstable? So I look at this of like, this place is really, really hot to begin with. I've been in places where I'm just like, I see people working outside and I'm like,
it's like, how are you doing?
I can't believe, like, can your body cool this? It's like 120 degrees.
Yeah.
And if you look at these forecasts and stuff like that, it's going to get worse. Do you have any thoughts on that when you were there?
I'll give you the answer, I think, for Syria, at least, of how it kind of played into the unrest a little bit. So John Kirby got raked over the coals recently because I think he made some statement that basically drew a sort of direct causal line between the unrest and climate change, which is not really true. But it is true that there was a tremendously awful drought that afflicted Syria between maybe 2006 or 7, so a few years before the unrest started. And what it did was it took farmers and a lot of people who lived out in the east, and it basically wrecked their fields, farms, the agricultural system that existed out there. Now, the drought was compounded by a whole bunch of like sort of awful Syrian water management policies and practices that made things a lot worse, including, you know, security services stealing and things like that. But there were like
classic.
There was a horrible drought, which in some way linked to change in climate, that was one important factor in driving many people from the east to these kind of ring, kind of almost shanty towns around the major cities in the west, Homs, Damascus, Hama, Aleppo. And these places were among sort of like the first to kind of go up when the protests started and when violence started, because you had people living here who were primarily Sunni Arab, so sort of outside of the ethnic and religious context of the regime, primarily lower class, who were sort of preyed upon by security services and the military and things like that. And they were sort of some of the first kindling for the unrest. Now, that's an oversimplified picture, but I think it's fair to say that drought played a role.
It's a variable.
It's a variable. And I think, you know, I mean, with anything that's extremely complicated, like the, you know, a civil war, the collapse of a country, like there are dozens and dozens of different variables that sort of feed into it. And I think that was one of them. And I think it was an important one because it drove a movement or helped drive a movement of people around these cities that made it much harder for the Syrian regime to contain the unrest and created a lot of kind of volatile surface area that got things going.
So the book is about many things, but there is watching a country implode, which is both a subject for the book and something you've lived through, something I've also watched. And it's really, I think particularly people listen to this podcast all over the world. Some people are in countries that have imploded, and some people that are in countries that haven't. And then there's, of course, you know, concern. The January 6th hearings are ongoing in the United States. I don't know whether you want to use the word implosion, but something, you know, really, really dangerous and scary could have happened here.
Right.
So just describe what it was like for you to be watching that happen. How did it change your thinking? How has it changed your writing?
It was ultimately like a really tragic thing to watch and really sad, like, it was so sort of, I think, scarring enough for me. I mean, I don't live there. Like, I know people who live there. I lived there. I worked on it, so I feel invested in some way. But I'm not a Syrian. But it was emotionally sort of racking enough that I felt like when I left the CIA, the thing I wanted to do was spend a couple months to actually just sit and kind of write to process it. And so
It
felt extremely sad because you have this strange dynamic that seemed to accompany it up front, which was that there's this sort of theoretical concern with what might happen, but no one really believes it, like, or they haven't internalized it emotionally.
You mean the notion of a country imploding, collapsing?
The notion of a country imploding, that people can kind of see it, like they can kind of picture it, but life is pretty normal for everybody. Even when the protest kind of starts, you're starting to, like, life is going on, right? Economic activity continues. People still go to the office. But what was fascinating to me and also terrifying is to quickly see how it's rare in these kind of instances where a central government's authority starts to weaken. Well, I should say what tends to happen are that the extremely committed radical people on either side of the equation become the ones who have the most power.
Right.
Who are the, you know, the most organized fighting units, who draw in the most foreign support,
right,
who start to command the space, whether it's the actual physical space or the information space. And those people can be really genuinely scary. And they were on both sides of the Syrian civil war. You know, I mean, this is a multifaceted, complicated place that has a ton of different parties involved. But, you know, you essentially ended up in the main parts of the country with the radicals being Assadists, you know, the sort of government militias who were, you know, their religion was Assad in the States. And then you have the guys in Salafi jihadists, Al-Qaeda, ISIS, who are trying to overthrow them. And those sides quickly became the most organized, well-funded ones who sort of drove the conflict. And there were points at which it was possible for there to be solutions, or at least a pause or some kind of way to stop the downward spiral. And it's sort of fascinating to watch that at each of those stages, you know, either sort of extreme either didn't want that or felt like they could win. And so they sort of just clear the game board of whatever negotiation was happening and press onward with the fighting. And they wrecked the place, you know, wrecked the whole country. It's pretty remarkable to watch the amount of human suffering that can occur in these kind of conflicts. And to see how it quickly becomes very logical. And I explore this with some of the characters in the book to a degree, like it quickly just becomes a, you know, we have to kill them or they're going to kill us situation. And you see how very normal people, you know, who aren't, you wouldn't sort of ascribe to them any kind of maybe psychopathy or sort of clinical narcissism or any of these kind of things that might be associated with people who just kind of don't frankly give a shit, but just normal people who kind of become stuck.
When the situation becomes psychopathic, they become psychopathic.
Yeah. Or they're willing to do things because it becomes logical. And that I found to be extremely scary and applicable anywhere, really.
Exactly what I want to get to. This is a quote in the book. It's a conversation between Fatima and Miriam, and the character says, "There's a system. Some people, the French, the Americans, are born into worlds that offer immense freedom. But we were not. We're Syrians. We're caged from birth for reasons deep in history." So, you know, I started my career in Russia, you know, watched the collapse of the Soviet Union firsthand, and, you know, continued to turn to some of this stuff in Syria in a second. But obviously, I think it's easier to see how places are caged in history a little bit if you're an outsider. And so that's a really profound statement. And so we can talk about that. But then at the same time, I look at cases like Germany, you know, in the 1930s. And it seems like, yes, people could be caged in history, but there could be moments of acute social instability.
Yeah.
So talk a little bit about Syria. Then also talk about how, like, step away from the book for a little bit. How concerned are you as somebody who's analyzed this about this happening in the United States?
Oh gosh. You
can say, I don't want to answer that, or I haven't thought about it, but I'm curious.
I think fundamentally, so to take Syria to start, you know, there is always this tension between the system that you're in and then you actually do have choice, right? And agency, you do over.
There's free will.
There's free will, right? But the Syrian system, particularly the one that has existed since the 70s under the Assad, has a lot more limits on that or higher consequences for exercising your free will when it comes to politics or you know, economics or political or economic life. You know, when I was writing the book and I'm thinking about these, for the most part in the book, the Syrians are, you know, writing through are kind of, they're relatively well-connected people with influence inside the government and they're in good families and stuff. And so they have seen that outsides, you know, sort of like the KGB first chief directorate guys in Russia who like saw outside the system and were like, yikes, you know, we're in a lot of trouble. You know, my Syrians are knowledgeable about what's going on in Europe and the United States and sort of understand that their
very
system,
much so.
Their system, while it gives them immense benefits in some respects, is an inferior one in many other respects to the more open systems that exist in Europe and the United States. And I think that both Miriam and then the Ali Hassan character at various points in the book sort of have this thing inside them that desperately wants to experience what that is like. And again, I'm not saying these systems are perfect, you know, by any stretch of the imagination, but they're much more open than Syria. And they desperately want to experience that. And yet they have families and lives inside Syria. And so they just, in many ways, can't. I was fascinated with how that tension plays out in a human because I have analyzed a lot of people who have experienced it and I've spent time with them and spoken with them, but I've never actually lived it myself, you know, because I feel like I have a lot of choice and agency and, you know, like there's many different paths in front of me that are potentially open. And I think places where that's not the case are pretty, I mean, it's sad, but it is also a fascinating study of human nature and the tension between a big system and your own personal agency that I think we all feel to some degree here.
Do you think it's possible for people to be heroic in that type of situation where they're confronted with no-win situations everywhere?
Oh, I do. Yeah. I mean, I think the person that actually pops into my mind, just because I was looking at a whole bunch of different photos of this incident I'd never seen before, is the guy standing in front of the tanks in Tiananmen Square in 89, you know, who's literally out there with like grocery bags and probably has some sense that like his life is then over, but a tremendous amount of moral courage goes into that, and he had the choice to do that or not. You know, he exercised that agency, but the consequences that the system then brings on someone for that are such that, you know, I don't think he's ever been heard from.
It seems like when you're in a situation that extreme, more modest forms of courage or heroism are almost impossible. The only way of doing it is almost like being willing to give your life.
Yeah.
I mean, it's what's happened to anybody in Russia who said, hey, I don't think this is such a great idea. Boom, you're dead.
Agree.
Or you're imprisoned forever.
Right. And a great book that I read on this, and specific to the Putin era, is Between Two Fires by a guy named Joshua Yaffa, who writes these stories, fascinating, colorful stories about people who have basically, they started in opposition, or they somehow found themselves opposed to Putin. And then it sort of tracks their journey in a very kind of humane way to people who don't love the system, but have made accommodation with it.
Right.
And I think that dynamic is interesting because it is much more nuanced than the person who is straight up, you know, Assadist or Putinist.
Yeah.
Or, you know, opposing them publicly and directly. And again, it's not a spectrum of sort of, I don't think one of them is more moral necessarily than the other, but it is this kind of like people make different choices under these kind of systems. And to your point, the degree of moral courage or heroism required to sort of even take small moves against a regime like Putin's Russia or Assad's Syria are so immense that most people find much smaller ways to exert independence or to show that they're opposition. Like there was a story I read on, I think this was, maybe this was, I want to say it was early 90s in Russia or something, but the way someone demonstrated opposition to a St. Petersburg official was he like took this, I think it was like a, someone in the St. Petersburg city government, they took like their shoes off going into a building and someone stole their shoes and just threw them away, you know, but like there wasn't like a, I have a placard or I'm haranguing you in a meeting. It was like this far more subtle, like I'm just going to take these shoes and no one's going to see it. I'm going to throw them in the trash to kind of show you.
And we skipped over you could just give a simple answer, high, low, or I don't want to answer the risk of that type of thing happening in the U.S. High, low.
Yeah, I know. I remember that I didn't answer that. And I was like, oh, man, he's going to come back. To gosh, I mean, you know, the thing that I kind of keep coming back to is that right now we have, I mean, this is the, take my Syrian lens and sort of apply it to the United States of America. We have pretty well-functioning, there's a lot of talk now, and it's obviously true that like a lot of our institutions aren't as strong as they once were, mm-hmm. and that there's not as much sort of, there's politicized views of a lot of our federal institutions. But we have pretty effective security services in the United States of America.
Mm-hmm.
The FBI is an effective organization. And so I have a hard time with like, and we live in a democracy that's not functioning like it did 10, 20 years ago, but that is a much more open system than many other places in the world or most other places in the world. And so I kind of come back to like, I think we're in a world where there's going to be more regular violence, street action, and the prospect of instability like that happening around every election. But I have a hard time imagining how you end up with a widespread, organized, militarized insurrection that doesn't get put down by our federal security services. Like, I have a hard time with that right now. But one of the things that was extremely sobering about the Syrian context and that I think is possible anywhere, although it does tend to be much more, these things tend to happen in authoritarian, much more authoritarian political systems. Like all of these things, like you can create a lot, very logical argument that it's unlikely to happen here. And then there can be mass psychological shifts that are completely unpredictable.
Yeah.
And that we're like the forecasting, like you're almost to the limits of like human cognition. Like you can't see these things coming, but it's like all of a sudden, you know, you see it in 89 in Eastern Europe. You know, you see it in Syria in 2011 and in many parts of the Arab world in 2010, 2011. It's like
Tiananmen Square, 89 too.
Tiananmen Square, there's a wall of fear, or there's a whole bunch of reasons not to do something until there's not. And then people's minds change about what's possible and the whole world changes. And I think that it's, you know, those kind of things do give me, I think, some amount of sobriety about what's possible here, because you know, things can change very rapidly and unexpectedly. And all of a sudden, you know, maybe we don't have a very effective security service capable or willing to dismantle groups that are, you know, sort of promoting a more localized form of control or trying to push out police or FBI from particular parts of the, you know, particular counties or something like that. Like, and then things can kind of get, you know, they get pretty nasty, because once you have armed groups that have territory, you know, it's terrifying.
So the name of the podcast is Things You Didn't Learn in School. By the way, nobody has given the same answers ever, and they've all been really, really interesting. I've got a catalog of them in my head now.
I feel like this is not something, and I probably started to learn this in school, but I didn't learn it at school. So maybe that's an important distinction on this one. The tremendous value in just being really stubborn and really putting in the work. I don't know if anyone said that, but
no.
I find that there is a lot to be said and just showing up and saying, I am going to do this and I am going to get it done. I'm going to do the work. The only way that I've gotten any books written or published or agented or anything has been by just forcing that out and being really stubborn about it. And I don't know. I'm not sure that's particularly insightful, but I do think the more I've just gotten a little bit older or maybe hopefully wiser, there's a lot to be said for just kind of showing up to things and doing things and pushing when you get resistance. So that's probably my biggest one.
There's a Cuban writer, I'm for spacing his name, but he said, I might not be the most talented writer, but I'm probably the hardest working. That's how he said he got to be where he was.
And,
it makes a lot of sense.
I think one thing, I think in a highly performative culture like the one, I mean, it's probably been like this for all time, but I think now it's much easier to sort of try to consume things in very, very small,
TikTok.
Easy to consume. Yeah, TikTok, whatever. I can consume this tweet or this little video, like, or I can get work done by sending 50 emails during the day that don't require me to really think.
Yeah.
I think it's become, we look at people who have immense talent and we just think that they had it, right? And then they were just sort of performing. Or that can be my assumption even now. And I think to your point, like, you know, like you read a novel, read any good novel. You can read any good novel, unless it's War and Peace, you know, in like half a day or something like that. I mean, if you sat down and wrote, you can consume that author's work in 8 hours, you know? And I think it's fascinating, like all of the best writers I know, they spend like a year or more writing that book, but they perfect it so that you drive through it and you experience it in a way that leaves you with this like really raw physical, you know, hopefully emotion. And that is, they're spending a whole year on that craft, you know, showing up.
At least. And some of them much longer.
But then they're agonizing over every word and every paragraph and every page and every sequence so that, you know, their performance is tip top. And I think you can't, like, they don't sit down and write those books in a month, which you could do.
This book may not be to your taste, but I read this recently. I don't know the other one, George Saunders, Swim in a Pond in the Rain.
Okay.
What he does is he's sort of like, I'm trying to get him on the show. So, George, if you're listening to this, don't be offended. He's kind of like a highbrow New Yorker writer, but he also teaches writing. And so what he does is he gets a bunch of classic Russian. He's not like a Russian specialist. He just gets classic Russian short stories, like six of them. And then he analyzes why they're so brilliant.
Mm.
And he goes into the degree of choices that the person is making there. And the stories are pretty good, but then you read his descriptions and you're like, wow. Now I understand why people read Chekhov 100 plus years later. And it's so understated. It's unbelievable. And so it's a little bit like watching a great magician. George explains the magic tricks. He literally will stop, like some of these stories I had read before. So he'll stop the story when you haven't gotten to the last page. It'll go, at this point, the author faces a choice.
Yeah.
Like, this is a pretty good story, but it's not really one that is like leaping off the page. So imagine, what would you do when you were in this situation? And it's absolutely fascinating. And then he just goes to the reveal for how the, like he pauses it, then how the author finished it. And you're like, okay, that is, you know, that is, you know, that's of that level type of thing. And it's incredibly subtle. You know, I had a friend of mine who was a musician, and I said, what's your assessment of Miles Davis? And he goes, he doesn't play many notes, just the right ones.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, thanks, I can do that.
It's like, what's the scene in MASH where, I think it's Hawkeye who has like one, he's talking about how he has one book. And it's the dictionary, you know. He's like, well, I feel like all the words are all the, you know, all the books are in there. That's the only one I need, you know. But it turns out finding the right order to put them in is, and choosing which ones is hard.
David, thanks so much for being a guest on Things I Didn't Learn in School. Good luck with your future endeavors.
Thank you, Paul. Great to be here.
Thank you for listening to today's episode. We're genuinely touched by all the support. If you want to see more of this type of content, sign up to my Substack on paulpodolsky.com and become a paid subscriber. That helps support the team. You could also submit a review to Apple Podcasts, which draws other listeners to this. If you have any questions, you can email me, paul@paulpodolsky.com, and follow me on Twitter, Instagram, LinkedIn. Thanks so much. Today's podcast was produced and edited by Dave Manahan.